The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and on this week's program, we've got the intel on all the gadgets and games that should and shouldn't be on your Christmas list. Joining me to pick over the spoils of the festive season are Charles Arthur, the editor of The Guardian's technology section, and Ben Stevens, technology reporter at Which. Welcome to the studio, both of you. Charles, what's on your wish list this year?
More spare time.
That's not
I suspect it's not going to happen. I mean, yeah, I'd settle for an extra 2 hours in the day, but that might not happen either.
Well, get you a time turner. That's what you need.
Oh, yeah.
From Harry Potter.
Absolutely.
I think we all need one of them. And Ben, I'm curious, not about what you want, because we'll be finding out a little bit more about that later, but what is the best Christmas present you have ever received? And this can go back to, you know, Lego when you were seven.
Wow. Best Christmas present. I'm not sure. It might be a globe. I received a globe when I was about 12 years old, and I do like
it. Was it actual size?
A little smaller.
Did it light up inside?
No, it wasn't that fancy.
They are fabulous. I discovered that you can get globes that open and have like cocktail things inside.
I was thinking sweets, Christmas sweets or nuts at Christmas. Perhaps.
Is this you discovering 60s films?
Yeah, exactly what happened.
The Thomas Crown Affair or something.
Indeed. Well, there'll be more of this over the next 30 minutes of the podcast, plus the latest news from the technology world. And this week, we find out what the implications of the UK government's release of an enormous trove of National Health Service medical data are for researchers, industry, and the public. We'll find out about a hack attack that used Gmail to spy on Iran, and we look at the numbers behind the steady decline of RIM's playbook. Keep listening to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. This week, Prime Minister David Cameron announced that the national health data about prescriptions distributed by GPs, plus the referral practices for secondary care services and hospital, will be made public via data.gov.uk. This is part of a dual-pronged strategy by this government to release data collected using resources from the public purse in order to promote transparency and accountability and to make the NHS more efficient. Previous data releases championed by you, Charles, everything from environment to transport information, have been relatively controversy-free. But the release of medical data, despite being anonymized, is obviously controversial. Charles, what are the details of what's going to be released and who it'll be released to?
There's going to be data sets from primary, that is GPs, and secondary, that is hospitals care, about providing health service, about pharmaceutical, other professionals will be able to get more information about the journeys of patients through the care system and the outcomes of different treatments, though this is going to be, as I say, anonymised. The NHS is going to be announcing data release services to help the healthcare research industry. And the idea is that you'll have a sort of a picture of how healthcare helps, what difference it makes, whether it makes a difference, which will almost be sort of cradle to grave. Now, this has been controversial because a lot of people say you cannot actually keep data anonymized. You can cross-match it in one way or another. You can look at map locations. You can basically pin down who the data is actually talking about. And that gets controversial. The Telegraph sort of tried to even more controversialize it by saying animal health testing companies will get their hands on health data, which one has to say, why is that a problem? But the issue about the non-anonymization, which is a hard word to say, is the bigger one. And Ross Anderson of Cambridge University has said, you know, that he thinks it's simply not possible to do that.
Well, joining us in the studio is Caitlin Thaney, the Manager of External Partnerships for Digital Science, which is part of the Macmillan Publishing Group, which is responsible for science titles, including Nature. Now, Caitlin, you are an open science enthusiast, and digital science itself is interested in technologies that will actually use this data. What are the benefits of this data for an organization like you?
So Digital Science is a technology company, so we try to provide tools that actually help researchers do better science, more efficient science, and science in the 21st century. A lot of the practices are still extremely analog.
So in what way will this data release benefit digital science and, in fact, benefit the medical and the academic community?
So beyond digital science for the actual research community, which is who we serve, it is extraordinarily important to be able to better understand disease. And having this information is kind of the first step, or at least one of the steps going forward. There have been a number of groups, whether they're actually within sort of the academic research world, or even now at pharmaceutical companies, which I know is, again, getting back to sort of the controversial side of things, of how this information could be used, that are looking at ways that they can start to mash up different sort of data and use better sort of drug discovery platforms that are much more sort of in the vein of open source so that they can better understand, say, malaria, you know, drug-resistant malaria or other diseases, or use negative results to try to kind of break down some of the roadblocks that we've been encountering thus far.
Now, how is this release of data different from other data sets that are out there that are also public?
When it comes to data that actually signifies and is mapped to the very personal experience of how people are responding to various therapies, and also even looking at how it is affected by the sort of market pulls. You know, what are the most popular drugs that are out there? What are some of the competitors? It just makes it a bit richer than what we have already.
Do you think that people should be concerned about the possibility of cross-matching, de-anonymizing information?
Well, I mean, I think people are always going to worry about it. But when it comes to the information sources that we're dealing with and also the tools we now have, you know, there is attention that needs to be paid to that, especially when it comes to, say, clinical trial information or privacy concerns or really being able to dive down looking at someone's postcode. But the benefits, I think, far outweigh the negative. And it's really difficult to future-proof this without knowing what the implications will be in the next 2, 5, 10, 50 years. And I think that locking that information down will just be really dangerous.
Thanks very much, Caitlin from Digital Science. Now, next up, the European Network and Information Security Agency this week released their analysis of a 2-month-long breach in security back in June of websites Google and Skype that suggests that Gmail and the VoIP service were used to spy on people in Iran. Charles, what?
The DigiNotar company, which issues digital certificates, was broken into by hackers. It's not known who the hackers were or quite who they're acting for. But what then happened was that false certificates were issued using that company and were then applied to create SSL certificates, which were used for a man-in-the-middle attack for people who are using Gmail and Skype in Iran.
So SSL certificates, just clarify for me. So this is a layer of security that says to a target, I am who I say I am.
You see, SSL is secure sockets layer. You see it when, for example, you're in your browser and you get the HTTPS prefix, and when you see a padlock in the browser, it indicates that you have a secure link between your PC and the remote site. It indicates that the conversation between the two is encrypted. However, if you have a man-in-the-middle attack like this was, then it means that actually the man in the middle, who's the one who owns the certificate, is able to decrypt and recrypt the conversation so that it appears to Google that you have an encrypted conversation, it appears to you have an encrypted conversation, but actually it's all being spied on.
But there's somebody listening in. Mm. Who was listening in?
The best guess is it's the Iranian government, because the attack was against people, as I say, in Iran who are using Gmail, and the suspicion is that it's not people who are sympathetic to the Iranian government who would be using that.
How common is this kind of attack?
Well, it's been quite an issue this year. There have been a number of these sorts of attacks, and the DigiNotar closed down as a result because it was used. It basically, its certificates could no longer be trusted. There was no knowledge of how many of these certificates had been issued. So all of them had to be basically rejected, which means that the Dutch government, I believe, which was using it for its tax revenue system, had to cease using it, and DigiNotar basically went out of business.
Well, we have more on this and other cybersecurity issues at guardian.co.uk/technology. And finally, Charles, it sounds like Rim, the makers of the BlackBerry, continue to struggle with their tablet offering, the Playbook. What are the numbers on this?
Rim issued a preliminary statement to their what is their third fiscal quarter of 2012, but actually it runs to the end of November. And in the first Friday of December, they issued a statement saying that they were going to take a $485 million write-off in the value of Playbooks, which are sitting basically in their warehouses. That these are not Playbooks that have been shipped out to retailers and are sitting on retailer shelves. These are the ones that RIM still has sitting around. They must have them piled to floor to ceiling, basically. I'm amazed they can move around.
Yeah, we've been talking about this for some time. This doesn't sound very good for the device.
The story for the Playbook never gets better. The initial shipment that they had in the quarter at the beginning of the year was 500,000. Everyone thought, okay, it's not doing the iPad business, but that's not so bad. Next quarter, it was 200,000. And they say that in the most recent quarter, it's been 150,000. That's shipped to retailers and to other outlets. However, they say that the number that were activated in that quarter was greater than 150,000. So it seems that some of the 700,000 that they managed to push out to the channel in the first couple of quarters, some of those are actually selling. However, having taken nearly $500 million in write-off on it, looking at their cash position, that has dwindled by $1 billion since August of last year. My calculations suggest they have about 2 million Playbooks sitting around. It's a bad story for them.
Ben, from a consumer side, what does this say about the quality of the machine? Or is this simply a blip in bad marketing?
I remember when the Playbook came out, there was a really aggressive marketing push. You saw it all over the metro, all over big billboards. I can't remember exactly what the claim was, but they were saying, you know, at last, here's the tablet you've been waiting for. But you just don't see them about. And I wonder if it's going to be along the lines of the HP touchpad story. You know, they'll have some fire sale. You can go and pick one up for £20.
Well, we'll be finding out more about different tablets in later on in the program. But we'll have more on these stories and the rest of this week's news as it unfolds at guardian.co.uk/technology. Tis the season, folks, and even in these austere times, I imagine that many of you are flexing the plastic to buy the latest gadgets and games for loved ones, and perhaps a cheeky one for yourself too. But technology shopping in this time of year can be a daunting task, with so many options for tablets, mobiles, audio and visual systems, cameras, MP3 players, headphones, games machine, games software. So much out there. And Ben, you spend your time parsing all of the gizmos in the market. Thank goodness somebody does. Let's take a whistle-stop tour through the best and the worst. Tell me about tablets. They seem to have gone absolutely mental this year.
They do. And tablets, at 14%, that's the most requested technology product this Christmas. But I think there's going to be a lot of disappointed people out there because is anybody, well, I'm sure some people will, but I don't expect many people to be giving £400 presents this Christmas. I mean, in my opinions, there's only really a couple of tablets that are worth considering. I would perhaps go for, obviously, the Apple iPad or one of the Samsung Galaxy Tabs, but are you really going to part with that much cash if you're giving it as a present?
Why do you think the low-cost Android tablets aren't worth considering?
I don't think they're as slick. The operation isn't as nice as with the better devices. We've come across some pretty ropey ones.
So, I mean, I've tried some of the sort of sub-£100 ones, and those really are the worst thing, the worst experience you can have on a tablet, I think. The Galaxy Tab, what's your reading on that? Because my feeling was that it looks just like an iPad, in fact, apart from the fact it runs Android.
It is very similar. I think that comes down to personal preference. There's a lot of people who will never give up their Android phones, and there are some people who will never give up their iPhones because that's what they use and that's what they like.
So the question there for the Christmas list is ask the person that you're thinking about buying a tablet for whether they're an Apple or an Android fan. A sidestep is ebook readers. The Kindle is probably going to be an enormously popular device this Christmas. What else is out there on the market?
Well, there's the Kobo as well, and that's being promoted quite a lot. You know, you can get it at WH Smith's, and that is, there are three versions out there. I don't remember the differences between all three versions. I think one's touch, one's not, and there's another one. But that's getting a...
One's a whisper.
Yeah, voice control. Yeah. But yeah, they're getting a big push this Christmas. We're getting a lot of interest from our readers. We've got them at our labs at the moment being tested. But the recent Kindle, the one that comes in at under £100, that did really well in our tests. And at £89 or whatever it is, the Kindle's a pretty good option.
I'm a big fan of cameras. And I don't think that everybody out there is going to be spending, dropping £1,200 for a Canon 7D for a loved one, perhaps for themselves. What kind of camera would you recommend for a tech fan?
I think this is when you've got to speak to somebody. If you're thinking of buying them a camera, talk to them, find out what they want. The choice really depends on what you want from it. Do you just want something that's really quick and easy, just point and shoot? Or do you want something a bit more specific? A growing trend is the compact system cameras. So it's a small camera. It's not as big as a clunky digital SLR, but you can change the lenses on it. So it's great. It opens up a lot of versatility, a lot of creative shooting options, but it's not as big and it's not as expensive. Samsung, Sony, Panasonic, Olympus, they all have their own versions. I just played with the Pentax Q recently, actually. It didn't do fantastically well in our tests, but it's like a spy camera. It really is so small. And when you remove the pancake lens, it feels like a toy lens. But it's great, really compact, bit fiddly to use because of its size. But I think... I think there's a lot of people who might like that camera.
The option to play around with the lenses is obviously is something that's quite nice. I imagine that even your all fully automated point and shoot cameras, they're probably declining because so many people have smartphones now.
Yeah, I guess so. And some of the cameras on smartphones, they don't rival decent camera shots. But if it is just point and shoot, then they're almost as good. And it's there. It's always with you. It's in your pocket.
Speaking of phones, is everybody going to be wanting an iPhone in their Christmas stocking? Can you imagine if that was a Christmas stocking favour, an iPhone? Wow, then you're made of money.
15% of children in a recent survey on YouSwitch asked for an iPhone this
Christmas.
You could
ask, doesn't mean you're going to get.
Yeah, that's right, they're
not
going to get.
You can plead to Santa, but sorry kids, those reindeer, they're not going to be bringing you one.
We've rounded up as the best sort of budget pay-as-you-go phones, so if you are thinking of buying a mobile phone for your children, because that is what they're asking for, then check out those. They're on our website, which.co.uk/Christmas2011. But I think the real killer phones this year that might rival the iPhone in terms of desirability, whether they're actually going to end up under the tree, is the Nokia Lumia 800, which is the new Microsoft Windows phone, and the second one being the Samsung Galaxy Nexus, which is the all-singing, all-dancing latest Android phone and running the ice cream sandwich version of the operating system.
Nokia, Charles, is not a name that we've been banding around in a positive light in this podcast. Is this something that might bring them back from whatever brink that we were portending?
Well, there's something like $1 billion being poured into the marketing for it, so which is all being transported across the ocean from Microsoft, those generous guys, because it's running Windows Phone software, which Microsoft has a big stake in. So for both Nokia and for Microsoft, it's very important that the Windows Phone's devices get a good start and that they continue that into 2012. The Lumia is a pretty high-end, it is a high-end phone, actually. It's, it's the pricing is around about the same as the iPhone 4S, pretty much the same as the Galaxy Nexus. So, if you're making a choice, it's really between those three. If you've got £500 that is burning a hole in your bank account. I think the Lumia is a fantastic piece of handset design. It feels really great in the hand. It really likes to be held. And it's interesting. It's curved where the iPhone is straight, and it's straight where the iPhone is curved. And it's just a really, really nice piece of design. It's not too big either. My issues with the software, I find Windows Phone has a lot of usability issues, which I've written about in my review of the HTC Titan. And I think in that regard, it's unfinished. Whereas Android with ice cream sandwich is a much more finished product, and Apple's iOS 5 is a really finished product. So there's not a great deal to choose from between them, but that's sort of how it stacks up for me.
This is making me hungry. Ice cream sandwiches, apples, you know, and you're talking about the curvature of the, oh, golly. Well, there you go. Thinking about audio, we've got things out there like iPod docks, which I imagine will fly off the shelves, or you know, even your hi-fi systems or your component systems. What would you recommend for a loved one?
I've tried a lot of docks this year. I tried some by Altec Lansing. I've tried Arcam, which both of which are pretty good. Though I have to say that Sonos, who do music streaming systems, a sort of mesh wireless mesh system, I think is just a really good product still. They got a thing called the S3 out, which is a small box which will do music streaming. It can do internet radio as well. You can control it from a smartphone. I still like that, actually. I think that's just a really great system.
The problem, though, with wireless meshing systems is that they demand consistent wireless, or else they fall over.
The thing about the Sonos one, though, is that it plugs into your router, and then it generates its own wireless mesh. So it's not reliant on how good your Wi-Fi is, because it generates its own Wi-Fi, and it is able to sort of do frequency hopping and all sorts of stuff.
Yes, consistent internet is not something that's happening in my house. Ben, we've tackled audio. What about video? There's a lot of video options. You know, there's 3D TVs, there's projectors. What's hot?
You know, I've just been putting together an ultimate Christmas present list when money is no option. And Samsung D8000 TV is top of the pile. It's one of the best, well, I think it actually is the best TV which has ever tested. Incredible picture quality. The 3D is pretty good. I mean, is there that much excitement about 3D? I'm unsure. But it's a great product. And a lot of the internet services that you can get through it, so the streaming of Love Film, you can get your catch-up TV. It's a product that works really well.
And what is the price point?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's above 1,000, below 2,000.
See, so for that, really I want it to actually massage me while I watch it. You know, I want it to make me a cup of tea. I want it to feed my cat when I'm away. Can you do that?
I think it's called a husband, Alex. How do you see it breaking down between 3D TV? Because LG has been pushing a 3G smartphone even. And smart TV, that is internet connected, enabled TV. How do you see that panning out next year, the next couple of years?
And can I throw another one into the mix, which is, a good monitor for a computer? Instead of buying a television, stream everything through your computer. Where do all of these things, where are they going to converge? What's going to happen?
Yeah, I think 3D is a bit of a gimmick. It's a bit of an add-on. Some people might like it, and it seems to be included on more and more tellies these days. If you go and buy a new TV, chances are it might have 3D included.
Are many people buying new TVs? I sort of get the impression everyone bought one about 2 years ago, and that was it, because they all upgraded to HDTV, and now they've gone, okay, done that.
Yeah, I'm not sure about those figures. I've heard that something like, is it 2 or 3 in 4 TVs that sold do have 3D capability, but I'm not sure what the total TV sales are right now. But I think the smart TV has greater benefits to the viewer. And I think if we finally do have UView, which is the service, it's going to be a mix between
a sort of iPlayer across all the channels.
Yeah, broadcast and broadband. So rather, when you look at your electronic program guide, not only do you see what's on TV right now, or you can see what's coming up on TV that afternoon, you can also look back in time and see what was on the BBC half an hour ago, 2 hours ago, yesterday, and you can just select your program and you don't know whether it's coming over the internet or if it's broadcast. And I think that will be a big bonus. Right now, it's not, smart TV isn't integrated quite as nicely. It's not just you press YouTube and there's entering search into YouTube or going through Love Film and setting up your account. It's not terribly well integrated.
So why not use a monitor?
Well, that's the thing. Using a monitor, I think that's fine, but it's a very personal experience. So if you have it as a computer monitor, it might just be there, on your desk or whatever. But in the living room, I think there's still a space for something that's a bit larger for the whole family to sit around. And if you're using it for your computer monitor, but you want to check your emails, what about, whoever sat next to you?
It's sort of the 10-foot experience against the 2-foot experience, yeah. Isn't it?
Ben, finally, is there anything else, you know, sort of novelties or stuff in your car? Should I be buying a refrigerator that orders my food for me?
There's a self-stirring mug. There's a bubble which actually has nothing inside it. So you are giving the gift of nothing, and that will cost you £5. There's a fake moustache for your dog, bin bags, the style of Christmas puddings, all sorts of nonsense things. I'd avoid all of those. If anyone got me any of those, I'd be very disappointed.
Well, we've spoken about a whole bunch of different things, and it sounds to me what you would say, Ben, that the thing to get this year would probably be a Kindle or a point-and-click camera? Or
I think the Kindle. Yeah, I don't think many people will be disappointed with the Kindle, and at £89, it's not going to break the bank.
Charles, what's your vote this year?
The thing that's not going to break the bank, but which is actually really useful if you're travelling a lot and you need to be doing stuff with your computer, I think, is the 3 has a little mobile dongle, the newly revised version of the mobile dongle, which can connect to a 3G signal and will then give you a mobile Wi-Fi hotspot. And it's really good, works really well. When my internet went down, I used that. And, saw through more than a week of not having any internet. So that's pretty good.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, Charles and Ben. And share any other ideas that you have with us at facebook.com/techweekly or on Twitter @GuardianTW. Now, we've only barely scratched the surface of all the many technological things that you can buy, and we've not even got onto games. Thankfully, Keith Stewart, the Guardian's games editor, gathered together Simon Parkin from Edge and Eurogamer and Keza McDonald, the UK editor for IGN, to go through the biggest titles of the season. Over to you, Keith.
What we've decided to do to keep this focused is to think about games in 4 different genres so that we can give you a good spread of games to think about for your Christmas. So the genres we've gone for: adventure games, shooting games, puzzlers, and family games. So we're going to try and recommend at least one title in each of those genres. And Simon, I was going to start with you and an adventure game that you'd like to recommend to our listeners.
The obvious choice here would be Uncharted 3, which was the big blockbuster from Naughty Dog on Sony PlayStation. I'm going to sidestep that just for a moment because you probably all know about that and have played it or own it, and talk about a curio, which is a Nintendo first-party title called Xenoblade Chronicles, which is a Japanese RPG in the style of Final Fantasy or Dragon Quest, except with most of the annoying tropes of that genre removed. It came out maybe 2 months ago. It hasn't made it to America yet, so you get to play it and feel smug about that. So you play as an adolescent boy, surprisingly enough, with an almighty sword.
I'm bored already.
Yeah. Oh gosh.
Do better. Right. The world is a giant robot. Okay.
All right, yes, that's
the
awesome.
Oh, okay. A giant robot. You walk around on the limbs of a giant robot. Already made it sound more interesting.
You did. But fundamentally, you play as a boy with a big sword. So there's no getting around that.
Wow. I'm a robot.
The robot is covered in moss and
right, because what people really want from their Christmas games is moss covered robots.
I mean, when I say it's giant, or when Keza says it's giant, it really is. It's gigantic. So the arm is like a kilometre long, and it's beautiful, and it's kind of vertical. So as well as just kind of running across deserts and things like that, you also run up limbs, although you don't really realise they're limbs till you get to the top and you look down and you go, oh my gosh, here's this universe and I'm standing on top of a robot god. It's really good. I don't think it sold that many copies, which is a shame because it's one of the best games of the year, definitely. So I recommend that for a good adventure.
Great. Thank you, Simon. Keza.
I'm going to be hideously obvious and go for the Elder Scrolls 5 Skyrim.
So what's good about this tiny short game?
It's this little mini game. Well, firstly, it will keep you busy for about 6 months, which is good. And it's basically the best fantasy game I think I've ever played. It's not perfect by any means, but its imperfections are just as lovable.
And it has a central quest, doesn't it? I mean, there is a central storyline, but
it's all about dragons, the central storyline. But basically, it's a first-person adventure game in which you can be whatever you want and just go and do anything. I'm a kleptomaniac in video games, so I like to steal people's items. I like to do that. I like to go into people's houses and root for loose change down the backs of their sofas. Or you can save the world from dragons. It's so broad, ridiculously broad. And everyone you talk to about this game has a different story from it. Even if you've done the same, you know, quest, you've all got a different story.
And doesn't it mould missions around the sort of gameplay that you indulge in?
It does,
well?
Yeah. So if you're, you know, are hanging around in places that are dangerous, then it will push you towards combat quests, and if you like exploring, it will push you towards more of those.
One of the games that I think those are two really good games. I maybe would add Dark Souls to this. I would guess you would probably call it reasonably hardcore RPG game from Namco. It's a sign of a sort of a follow-up to a game called Demon's Souls, which came out in Japan in 2009 and came out here in 2010. And it's basically a game where you explore a trap-filled series of gothic citadels and are killed time and time again by hideous beasts and traps you never saw coming. But I think, I mean, it's a great game. It's a brilliant game to indulge in over Christmas, I think, because if you've got a few days off, you really do need a lot of time to play it, don't you?
It's not the kind of thing you can play in 20-minute intervals.
No.
I think it's brilliant. I absolutely loved it. It's one of my favourite games of the year. The difficulty is true. It's very hard, but it's also very fair. So it's a game that's enjoyable to... You don't feel like you're banging your head against a brick wall. Every time you retry a section, you feel like you're learning and the game's kind of improving you rather than improving the avatar, which is quite... I guess it runs contrary to current fashions and for that reason is interesting.
And one last game that I think we should add maybe as a sort of an action-adventure game would be Batman Arkham City, which is much more kind of mainstream than the games we've talked about. We've talked about fantasy RPGs, really, was Batman Arkham City, the sequel to the brilliant Batman Arkham Asylum, is a big console superhero game, but with a much more explorable environment. It's Batman in a sectioned-off section of Gotham City, which has been given over to criminals. It's kind of like Escape from New York, the old John Carpenter film. I thought this was an amazing game, if only because what everyone says about the game is it allows you to be Batman, and the combat is so fluid and so nicely produced, and you feel so good at fighting, even though it does test you. It's got loads of great characters in it, loads of great moments in it, a real kind of feel for the gothic universe of Batman.
Super puzzles as well.
Yeah. Let's go in a different direction. Let's go for Puzzler, I'll start with you this time, because...
Portal 2.
Okay.
Which I completely forgot even came out this year.
Yeah, it was early, February, March. Yeah.
Astonishingly accomplished puzzle game. Essentially, it's very difficult to explain, isn't it? Man, you have a gun that shoots, like, interdimensional portals in walls. So you can shoot one on a wall next to you and one on a wall at the other end of the room, and you can walk through it and emerge at the other end of the room. The way that this is applied throughout the game is just remarkably inventive. It's got the best writing and story of, I would say, any shooter.
Yeah, yeah.
Slash puzzle game ever.
You're in a laboratory which is being run by... It's a sequel, but it works by itself. You don't have to have played the first Portal.
Essentially, there's an evil robot. There's the theme. There's a theme emerging. There's an evil robot.
but this one isn't covered in moss.
Not covered in moss. Controlling a laboratory which you're trying to escape.
And at the start of the game, you bump into a small droid who's voiced by Stephen Merchant, who does a very good job, and it's the last person you expected to do a voice in an American game, but he sort of helps you get to grips with this world and what you have to do in it. But it's essentially a series of physics puzzles based around projecting yourself through these portals. Simon,
we should have conferred before we started this because this was my choice.
Well, I know it's mine as well.
Right, okay.
We're allowed to agree.
But that's okay. Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah, it's all right.
Because your mode of interacting with the game is kind of like a first-person shooter, but you don't fire bullets, you fire portals. So it's almost like a pacifist FPS. So it's quite countercultural in that way, which makes it interesting and enjoyable as well. Mm. And the fact that you play a woman in it as well, is that significant? That you're not firing bullets. I'm not sure. Where am I going?
No, I don't know where you're going, but I'm coming with you. what I love about it, and what I loved about the first game was, and I'm often saying is it's one of those very, very rare games, and you very rarely see them these days. They were more common in the 80s, where you feel when you've solved a puzzle, you feel as if you've solved it in such a way that you can't imagine anyone else thinking of that. Lemmings was another one that I used to feel like that about. But it's not really that open in its design. It's just the way that it makes you think about design and structure and the way that game worlds work. So yeah, well, I'm trying to think of any other puzzlers that I thought were up there with it.
Did Tetris come out this year?
Tetris comes out every year,
right? Yeah.
So
there's got to be an iPad puzzler.
Quarrel.
Quarrel.
Yes. On but it's harder to give as a Christmas gift.
You can gift it on iTunes.
Oh, you can. Yeah. So. If you're going to give people, if you want to give people, it's a Quarrel is
keep up, Grandad.
Yeah. let's try shooters. So shoot 'em up games. I feel there might be some agreements here, Simon.
Yes, I'm going to go for the populist choice and say Modern Warfare 3, which it kind of makes you wince saying that a little bit. I don't know why. Maybe that's because we're core gamers and there's kind of this backlash against that whole series and Activision and Bobby and all of that. But then you sit down and you play the game and it's completely amazing and it runs at 60 frames per second like nothing else. And it's fast, it's engaging. The single player campaign is super creative. Even though it's a corridor shooter, the set pieces are marvellously thought out and very exciting. And then the Spec Ops mode, in which you and a friend play through a series of missions together, is really fun. I've been playing that all week. And then, of course, the multiplayer arena that was established with the first Modern Warfare in 2007 and kind of redefined online shooters is just as strong as ever. Mm. And the fact that that game managed to come out and be so good, despite the fact that half the development staff at Infinity Ward walked out halfway through the development process, is sort of remarkable. I don't know how they did it, but
partially they bought Sledgehammer, a new development studio, right, yeah.
I don't want the answer. I just want to think it's magic.
Okay, it's nothing to do with Sledgehammer. It is in fact Pixie Magic. Right. So yeah, I've had it confirmed.
Yep.
Keza.
I think I agree. I'd love to say Battlefield 3 just to be contentious, but I just didn't like it quite as much as I like Modern Warfare 3.
It's just a fantastic roller coaster ride, and I don't care if I'm following someone all the way through, even though sometimes you do think, can I just go off by myself? No? All right, then I'll follow you anyway.
I'm still holding out for a proper first-person single-player shooter, which I think next year will be good for, because I've got Bioshock Infinite.
Yes,
I was disappointed this year by the standard. Yeah. Battlefield 3's single-player was really...
It wasn't really there,
really
was it?
But I mean, that just shows how difficult it is to do the Modern Warfare template, because I mean, that was quite clearly...
It was trying.
You know, nothing against DICE's talented designers, but they were obviously trying to
Bad Company 2 was a brilliant single-player shooter.
Yeah.
And they just didn't translate any of that into Battlefield 3. It was really
sad. But because I think they were trying to ape Modern Warfare so much.
Maybe they should be themselves.
I think we all agree, because I would have said Modern Warfare 3 as well, because of... Not because of the single-player game. I totally understand why people hate it. I don't understand quite why they're so vociferous about it, because it's just a video game and hell, you know, it's not like we're talking about the end of the world here. But there's the Spec Ops mode as well. There's multiplayer, which if you want to run and gun and be shot for half an hour a day, is perfect. Battlefield 3 is amazing. It's great multiplayer. It's very in-depth, very tactical. I wouldn't recommend so much going into it just by yourself, but you should have like four or five friends with you. But you're saying about single-player games, and I was going to say maybe people should buy Deus Ex Human Revolution.
That was what I was going to actually pick up as my... But then I couldn't figure out whether it was a shooter or not.
Very quickly, Bulletstorm. I know lots of people didn't like this, but I thought Bulletstorm, which came out in February and didn't really sell, and it's a shoot-em-up, a mad anarchic shoot-em-up set on this destroyed kind of fantasy planet that's been created as some sort of leisure planet, but has fallen apart. You crash land your spaceship on it, and you've got to try and capture the man that betrayed you. But it's a ridiculous story, really funny characters, and really I just found the dialogue hilarious. I thought the action was really good. I thought the weapons and customization were great. Kez is looking at me as though I am insane.
I disagree vastly.
Really?
Yeah, I hated Bulletstorm. I couldn't get behind the humor. I just couldn't. I just didn't find it funny.
Obviously not been called enough names. Honestly, write a good review of Modern Warfare
3. I get called a lot of names.
Okay, so our final one is family. Family games. This is kind of open, and it's things that you can maybe sit down with two or three people, or sit down with kids and play. So, Keza, what will you be playing in front of your fireside at Christmas?
Mario Kart.
Okay.
Well, I'll be playing Mario Kart with all of my tiny nephews.
Mario Kart 7 on
the 3DS. Mm-hmm. It's a dangerous productivity impediment. And it's got great local multiplayer.
Okay.
And even if only one of you's got a copy of the game, you can still have fun and play it. I think it's the ultimate family kind of game.
Okay.
I would say Zelda, but it's actually 12 rated.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Which is
really
weird, because it's a Zelda game.
Why is that?
Because that's sexy. Maybe
it's all the actual
hot
physical...
coffee.
Have you not seen the ending? I think it must be the physical violence. I should have mentioned it in Adventure, really, shouldn't we?
Yeah, it's too late now.
Yeah. Oh, well,
your Zelda moment is past.
Too late, everyone.
Yeah. Simon.
I'm going to go for Lego Harry Potter Years 5-7. Mm. It's definitely formulaic in terms of carrying on what Traveller's Tales have done since the first Lego Star Wars game. In terms of, you know, you get to build objects in order to solve puzzles, and you get to destroy objects in order to collect studs. And when the more studs points you collect, the more characters you can buy and cheats and stuff like that. So they've got the template completely nailed. This one, I think, is good because the kind of structure that they laid out works really well with the Harry Potter mythology, I think. There's kind of a sense of magic and logic in J.K. Rowling's stories that work really well in video game form. And yeah, they just have kind of given it a nip and a tuck from years 1 to 4, and so I enjoyed that very much.
Yeah.
And then I'd also like to just give a little mention to Disneyland Connected Adventures, the one in which you walk around the park.
Disneyland Adventures.
Thank you.
There's two games that I would like to add. Once Upon a Monster, which is from Double Fine Productions, and it's a Sesame Street game, which sounds like it's going to be for really young kids, but it's for kids and anyone else who likes the idea of being in a Sesame Street story world written by the creators of games like Psychonauts and Stacked. I think that's a really charming game, and it's basically about the Sesame Street characters trying to help. You're in a story world, and you're trying to help 6 monsters with various tasks. I think we've sorted out Christmas for you well and truly. So I think there's some games there. So so the games that we're all putting forward then are Portal 2, Modern Warfare 3,
Xenoblade Chronicles,
excellent, and maybe Bulletstorm if you don't mind being called an asshat every 10 seconds.
Yes,
and
Dark Souls and Skyrim.
Yep. Yeah. Wow, that's your Christmas stocking's going to be stuffed full of goodies this year.
It's been the best year ever.
Yep.
That was Keith Stewart talking with Simon Parkin and Keza McDonald. So I hope we've made your Christmas buying easier. Let us know at techweekly@guardian.co.uk if we've missed anything off your list. Details are also on Witch's website and, of course, guardian.co.uk/technology. That is it for this week. Many thanks to our studio guests, Ben and Charles and Caitlin. Thanks to Keith Stewart and his panel, and to our producer this week, Scott Colley. Over the next few weeks, we will be rounding up the year and forecasting the technosphere of 2012. There will be the annual Christmas roundup of the most hilarious outtakes of the year. So keep your ears on Tech Weekly for those festive delights, and do let us know what you found under your tree or your Hanukkah bush. I'm Alex Kratosky. See you next Tuesday.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.